It's the NPR News Update podcast for Friday, May 9. Hi, I'm Phil Picardi. Today, a farewell to an 18-term Minnesota congressman. Rochester marks a century and a half of Mayo. The state works to connect more kids with mental health services. Problems at the Bait Shack. Who's allowed to sell during the Minneapolis All-Star Game and where? And Teddy? Football? First, a bill that aims to improve the working conditions of women is headed to Governor Dayton for his signature. The Minnesota Senate passed the so-called Women's Economic Security Act. The measure increases the amount of unpaid parental leave time employees can take when they have or adopt a child. DFL Senator Sandy Pappas says it also requires large companies that contract with the state to certify they provide similar pay to men and women in similar jobs.
For 50 years, we have assumed that we have equal pay for equal work, and the whole purpose of this bill is to see if that's the case, if we can find out, get a handle on why we have this stubborn pay gap.
Critics of the bill worry the requirement on state contractors will result in a greater number of lawsuits. A new poll shows confidence among Minnesota factory executives is at its highest point in 6 years. Annie Baxter reports.
The survey research was paid for by the manufacturing consulting group Enterprise Minnesota. A polling firm conducting the survey received responses from about 280 factory executives. Bob Kill, Enterprise Minnesota's chief executive, says 84% of survey respondents say they're confident about the future of their firms. That's the highest level in the poll's 6-year history.
They're seeing their profitability, their revenue return. There's still a conservative twinge to their comments. You see that in their capital expenditures being kind of flat the last couple years, which says they're still a little bit reticent on making these long-term expensive investments. But that will follow.
Kill says the share of factory executives who are concerned about attracting and retaining qualified workers has jumped sharply in recent years. Annie Baxter, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Bicyclists, pedestrians, and a light rail train took over a downtown St. Paul street yesterday. It was all to help visualize a future without car traffic. Laura Ewan has more.
Some downtown boosters are pushing to turn 4th Street into a bike walk greenway to be shared with a new Green Line train. Bike lane decals and sidewalk tables popped up for the day. One of the organizers, Executive Director Jessica Treat of St. Paul Smart Trips, says 4th Street isn't included in the city's recently released plan for a downtown bike loop, but some building owners and businesses are pushing for it.
They get that it's about economic development and placemaking. They want to have cafes in front of their businesses. They want to have a really enlivened street, and they think that doing that with biking and walking would be really great.
The city's bike plan currently calls for placing the loop along St. Peter, 10th and Jackson Streets, and Kellogg Boulevard. The Green Line opens June 14th. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
One well-known champion of bicycling and transportation in general was longtime Minnesota Congressman Jim Oberstar. He was buried yesterday just outside of Washington, D.C. Oberstar died last weekend at the age of 79. Oberstar represented northeastern Minnesota's 8th District for 36 years. As Brett Neely reports, mourners at his funeral celebrated Oberstar's legacy.
Jim Oberstar's funeral mass was held in the same Catholic church he attended every Sunday morning. Hundreds of mourners, including family, former staffers, and dozens of current and former members of Congress, filled the pews. While politics was an enormous part of Oberstar's life, his daughter Monica Weber said it wasn't the only part.
He will be revered as the quintessential public servant. But to my brother, my sisters, and I, we will always remember him for his patience and tenderheartedness.
Another daughter, Noelle Tower, recalled Oberstar's passion for learning languages, which included a mastery of French and Creole.
He explained that really learning a language, understanding its nuances, was opening a window to another culture.
François Delattre, France's ambassador to the United States, said Oberstar truly loved France and French culture.
By the way, he spoke French better than I do. Which for a French ambassador, it's really a problem.
Oberstar was known around Washington as Mr. Transportation because of his mastery of the complex policy issues surrounding the topic. He helped encourage the growth of bike lanes nationwide, in part, Monica Weber said, because of his own passion for cycling.
On family reunions, we would enjoy activities such as short little 30-mile bike rides.
Oberstar began his nearly 50-year career in public service as a congressional staffer working on transportation issues. Senator Amy Klobuchar said Oberstar's many years on the House Transportation Committee left a legacy few lawmakers can match.
During the time, he literally changed the landscape of our country.
Family and friends alike joked fondly about Oberstar's loquacious speaking style. Senator Al Franken said Oberstar would likely start a speech about transportation policy by beginning with the history of the construction of the Erie Canal in the early 19th century.
But it was because he believed that everyone was as curious about the world as he was, and he was almost always wrong about that.
Oberstar lost his seat in the Tea Party wave election of 2010. His son, Ted Link Oberstar, said that while he believed the country has suffered as a result of that election, Oberstar's family gained.
Perhaps one of the few things, the few blessings, was that we had more time with Dad.
Oberstar was a mentor to many young staffers, policy experts, and politicians. Klobuchar described a lawmaker who resisted the cynicism Americans feel about political life.
He didn't think politics had a bad name. He thought that it meant something, and he wanted other young people to go into this profession.
In lieu of flowers, Oberstar's family asked that friends contribute to the Safe Routes to Schools National Partnership, one of the many programs Oberstar created in his long career. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
This year marks 150 years since William Worrell Mayo opened a medical practice in Rochester. Mayo's two sons went on to transform their father's small practice into the Mayo Clinic of today. Mayo is the largest private employer in Minnesota, and its Rochester campus attracts hundreds of thousands of patients and visitors from around the world each year. As Mayo commemorates its sesquicentennial, reporter Elizabeth Baer looks back at some of the clinic's top medical accomplishments.
The story started with an assignment. Earlier this week, I asked Matt Dacey to pick Mayo's five most important medical contributions. Dacey's director of the clinic's museum. It's a collection that includes early photos, some of the very first medical devices, and the original offices of both Mayo brothers. Dacey knows Mayo's history perhaps better than most, and these are his top picks.
One would be our primary value, the needs of the patient come first.
That's a phrase you hear from bedside nurses and Mayo's president and CEO. The philosophy goes back to 1910, when one of the Mayo brothers gave a commencement speech at a medical college in Chicago. Dacey says while discoveries will come and go, the organization's primary value will live forever.
We have to deal with economics, we have to deal with technology and systems, but we do those in service to patients. And I think that's helping to set Mayo apart from other healthcare providers even more so today.
The second important Mayo contribution to medicine came from one of the Mayo brothers' early hires, Dr. Henry Plummer. Plummer brought organization to the operation and developed what's become the modern-day medical record. Before that,
every doctor had a ledger, like a big old banker's book. You know, boom, you'd open it up and you'd flip the page and you'd write the notes.
Dacey says as doctors saw more patients, those notes and records became more chaotic. Plummer developed a paper dossier, a folder that moved around by conveyor belts, pulleys, and pneumatic tubes.
And so it became not a single doctor's private notes, but the institution's record for everyone. And so each doctor then contributed to that record, but the record moved around and was stored centrally. So a total change in philosophy, but it was transformational.
Next on Dacey's list of contributions is Mayo's status as a nonprofit. At the turn of the 19th century, the Mayo brothers Will and Charlie began to invest half their income in a philanthropic fund. That became the base of a gift and the beginnings of the clinic's status as a nonprofit. Dacey says the value of that gift today would be estimated at more than $100 million.
They decided that the way to secure the future of Mayo Clinic was to give it away. So they signed over all the assets of the organization, the land, the buildings, the equipment, and the majority of their own personal life savings to endow what we call Mayo Clinic as a nonprofit organization.
The last two important medical contributions on Dacey's list focus on specific medical discoveries. Number four is the discovery of cortisone. Mayo researchers won the 1950 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for discovering the anti-inflammatory steroid. But Dacey says what really made that a breakthrough was the way Mayo took its research and applied it to patient care.
Research here is so connected to outcome, so that if whatever condition you may have, whatever health need you may have, we're doing research for that, but it's with you in mind, you as the patient. So that's why cortisone is emblematic.
Last on Dacey's list is Mayo's contribution to medicine during World War II. As the war got underway, people realized aviation would play a key role in the outcome. But there was a problem.
Mechanics had evolved, so planes could fly at higher altitudes, but of course human physiology had not changed. So pilots and crews were blacking out, crashing their planes, and oftentimes being badly hurt or dying in the crash.
So Mayo brought physicians, nurses, and technicians together in what was called the Mayo Clinic Aeromedical Unit. The clinic charged the U.S. government $1 per year for this top-secret research. And some of the unit's innovations are still in use, including the high-altitude mask and the anti-blackout G-suit, a version of which is worn by pilots today.
That's Elizabeth Baer in Rochester. There's some good news for kids who need mental health services. Minnesota's Department of Human Services has announced $45.4 million in funding for mental health services linked to schools. And the money will come in the way of five-year grant contracts designed to serve about 35,000 students in more than 800 schools. The announcement follows commitments Governor Dayton and lawmakers made last session to double early intervention and treatment services for students. Tom Cran talked about it with Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen.
So first, take us through the numbers here. We're talking about a little more than $45 million. What kind of an increase is that on, let's say, the past fiscal year?
Starting in fiscal year 15, we'll have doubled the amount we're spending on this program. And it will not only double the amount of spending, but it doubles the number of kids we can serve. You know, and most of the kids served by these grants will have never had mental health services before. About half of them won't have had treatment. It's a big step.
What will this money actually do? Who will it hire? How will it get to kids?
Well, what this money does is let schools link up with mental health organizations so that when a teacher or another school worker sees a child that perhaps needs some screening or early intervention or other services, they'll then be able to reach out to the parents, see if the parents will agree, and quickly provide those services to that child.
Why do it that way and not just, let's say, pay for more school counselors, which some people, including the Minnesota School Counselors Association, say Minnesota's lagging behind, 48th out of the states in the nation.
There's no doubt that we need more school counselors. But school counselors do a lot more than just provide mental health services and referrals. When I think about counselors in schools where my children attended, they were helping them plan courses. They're helping them with, you know, maybe their college applications.
There's academics,
a lot,
sure.
Academics. Yeah, yeah. So this is really a niche of making sure that we do the early intervention, the prevention, and if necessary, meet the crisis needs of children with mental health needs.
A lot of people may be listening thinking, well, this is something for families and maybe their doctor, their pediatrician, family health. Why is this so important to get at in schools?
In Minnesota, we really have a lot of access problems to mental health services for all children. I go around the state a lot, and I hear that from families and providers and school members. So one of the things this does is help address that access problem for all children, especially in greater Minnesota. I hear from parents that say, look, to get my child to a mental health provider, I have to take him out of school, take time off my job, and drive 2 hours. And schools are where children spend a lot of time. Having those access points in our schools is going to mean that more children are getting help.
I have some numbers here that statewide, since about the last decade, There's been an increase in spending on children's mental health from $181 million to $289 million. That's over $100 million. What are the tangible results of that $100 million being spent additionally over the last 10 years?
I think some of the tangible results you see very much when you go into a community where you have these sorts of services and you talk to parents and children and school officials, and they'll tell you about children that get services earlier that then don't drop out of high school, that are able to stay in school. I talk to kids who tell me about, well, when my parents were getting divorced, my family is falling apart, but I got help, and now I'm able to stay in school. I'm looking forward to college. So I do think we have we need to measure more kind of some of those more concrete outcomes. But what we've seen so far in the areas of the state where this has been in effect is much better progress for children, and that's why the legislature and governor said, let's do more of this.
Lucinda Jessen is the commissioner of Minnesota's Department of Human Services. Thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that was Tom Cran on All Things Considered and the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Many anglers heading out for the weekend's fishing opener are stocking up on live bait. But bait dealers say regulations designed to prevent the spread of invasive species make it more difficult for them to collect the bait that anglers want. Dan Gunderson reports.
May is an important month for Bill Powell's bait business. He catches much of his bait during the spring when minnows spawn. Powell runs Fred's Bait in Deer River, just northwest of Grand Rapids. He supplies bait to stores and resorts in about a 100-mile radius. But Powell says DNR regulations keep some prime bait lakes off limits.
Right now they're shutting us off before the minnows even come in to make their big spawning run.
Any lake in the state that's infested with zebra mussels is closed to bait collection between May 16th and October 15th. The DNR says it's important to close infested lakes to bait collection when veligers, the young zebra mussels, are floating in the water. Veligers are too small to be easily seen, and they could be transferred in the water with the minnows. Powell says last year, zebra mussels were discovered in Lake Winnebogoshish, one of the prime minnow lakes in northern Minnesota. So the lake was closed to bait dealers just a couple of days after the ice went out. That left him with a shortage of shiner minnows, a popular live bait for anglers on northern lakes.
If you get around Mille Lacs area, they don't depend on shiners as much as we do. They fish a lot more with leeches and stuff down there. Up here, everybody wants shiners because that's what they're in the lakes is a natural food source. So most people, if you don't have shiners and they think there's a chance that they can get them someplace else, they'll turn right around and walk back out the door.
There's another invasive species hurdle for dealers like Powell who collect shiner minnows. Dealers who collect certain species of shiners must test the fish for VHS, viral hemorrhagic septicemia, before they can legally sell them. The deadly disease is now found in Lake Superior, and the DNR is trying to prevent its spread. Shiner minnow species are susceptible to the disease. Powell says once he sends in a fish sample, it takes about a week for test results to clear a lake for bait collection.
You know, last year there was a pretty good run of minnows on a little lake north of here, and a lot of the local fishermen went and seined them up themselves for their own use, but I couldn't go there because the lake hadn't been tested.
Commercial bait dealers have to satisfy some regulations that don't cover individual anglers. Dealers must take annual aquatic invasive species training. Powell says it's frustrating to watch anglers collect bait he can't access. DNR aquaculture and fish health consultant Paula Phelps says anglers also need to comply with bait regulations. But while the agency has a list of licensed bait dealers, she says there's no way to know if individual anglers are following the rules.
They have to read through the regulation booklet that comes out every year when they get their angling license, and some people do that and some people don't. So,
what would be the key message to anglers?
That harvesting bait in designated infested waters is risky, and that in general it's not allowed.
Phelps says the DNR is just starting a review of all invasive species regulations affecting bait collection.
And what we're looking for is just to see, A, are these effective? B, are there places where we can either loosen things up or need to make things more stringent? And C, can we simplify things? Because it can get confusing.
Phelps says the agency is encouraging bait dealers and anglers to offer suggestions on ways the regulations can be improved.
Dan Gunderson in Moorhead. The city of Minneapolis faces a lawsuit over special regulations to accommodate this summer's Major League Baseball All-Star Game. The rules restrict commercial activity in several designated clean zones unless the vendors have the league's permission. The American Civil Liberties Union says the clean zones violate the Constitution. Here's Curtis Gilbert.
When Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig announced Minneapolis had succeeded in its bid to host the All-Star Game, he promised the event would mean big money for the local economy.
And I think I can conservatively say here today that this game will produce, at a minimum, $75 to $100 million just for those 5 days. It is enormous.
But the league wanted to make sure that none of that money would make it into the pockets of people who peddle knockoff baseball merchandise. And so, as part of its agreement with the city, the league required the clean zones. They'll cover all of downtown, plus parts of the University of Minnesota campus, and a small pocket in the northeast part of the city. For 10 days before and 5 days after the July 15th All-Star Game, the city has agreed not to issue any temporary business licenses for those zones without league approval. It will also give the league authority over temporary signage viewable from public property, an effort to block what the city council resolution calls ambush marketing. Grant Wilson oversees business licensing for Minneapolis. He told the council earlier this year the zones would make it easier to manage the myriad events happening around the game.
We need to coordinate all of those events to make sure that our traffic control, our police, our homeland security all know exactly what's going on at every corner.
But not every event planned for mid-July in downtown Minneapolis is connected to the All-Star Game. January 20th, the final day the clean zones are in force, happens to fall on the 80th anniversary of a pivotal moment in Minneapolis labor history. It was a deadly confrontation between police and striking Teamsters, including some who were interviewed decades later for an NPR News documentary.
All of a sudden, when the cops cocked their guns and stepped back, not a word said, they just stepped back, and the shooting started.
All they were doing was shooting. They were just standing there from all directions. Everything, it was just bullets flying. Bang, bang, boom, boom.
Police shot 67 people in downtown Minneapolis that day in 1934. Two died, and Bloody Friday turned public opinion in favor of organized labor. Jim McGuire is planning a street festival to mark the anniversary. Because it falls within the clean zone, he worries any signs will be considered contraband, and he won't be able to get the food permits he needs from the city. McGuire hasn't asked permission from Major League Baseball to allow the event to go forward, and he says he shouldn't have to.
The Pollads, the Steinbrenners, and Bud Selig don't get to decide when, where, and how we commemorate this important part of our history.
The Minnesota ACLU has taken his case. Executive Director Chuck Samuelson says it's unconstitutional for the city to delegate its licensing authority to a private corporation.
We do not give that power to Major League Baseball, nor to Cargill, nor to Target, nor to any other private, nonprofit, or for-profit company. That power resides with our elected officials.
Major League Baseball, which is not a party to the lawsuit, declined to comment on it. Minneapolis City Attorney Susan Siegel issued a statement offering to meet with the ACLU and discuss its concerns. She said, quote, "We will not and would not violate free speech rights regardless of the All-Star Game or any other national event occurring in our city." Clean zones are common for high-profile national sporting events. A clean zone for last year's Super Bowl also drew a lawsuit from the ACLU. In response, the city of New Orleans agreed to scale back the zone's restrictions. The NFL retained veto power over temporary businesses in the zone, but the city lifted limitations on signs and political demonstrations.
Curtis Gilbert in Minneapolis. Now it's sports time to close out the podcast. The Vikings grabbed a linebacker and a quarterback in the first round of the NFL draft last night. They had a chance to get Johnny Football, Johnny Manziel, in the draft, but they passed. Kathy Werzer talked football this morning with Star Tribune digital sports editor Howard Sinker.
How tired are you? You must have been up almost all night long with this draft business.
It was a long, long day, and just when you think things are wrapping up, the Vikings make a trade with the Seattle Seahawks to get back into the first round so that they could take Teddy Bridgewater, the Louisville quarterback. it was a pretty incredible night on one hand. On the other, Rick Spielman, the general manager, has made deals like this the last 3 years.
Now, who is Teddy Bridgewater?
Bridgewater was a quarterback at Louisville, which has a highly successful college football program. And for a while, he was seen as the number one quarterback available in the draft. He had a very poor workout on what they call pro day, when scouts and coaches come in to watch a player perform at a college. But the Vikings had went and watched him work out privately. They had done a lot of interviewing. They had done enough to be very comfortable with taking him. He was the third quarterback taken after a quarterback from the University of Central Florida, and of course Johnny Football, Johnny Manziel from Texas A&M, who people were coveting for all kinds of emotional reasons.
I see. So we obviously need a quarterback. So you think this fills the bill?
Well, you never really know. The Vikings now have three quarterbacks on their roster. They're obviously not happy with Christian Ponder. Matt Cassel is really sort of seen as a caretaker, journeyman kind of quarterback. Whether Bridgewater plays sooner or later remains to be seen, or even at all. You never really know how college players will adapt to the pros, no matter how many accolades are thrown out last night after the draft or today when Bridgewater comes to the Twin Cities. It's just such an uncertain thing that right now the best answer is you just don't know.
Now, the Vikings picked up Anthony Barr. That was the team's first pick last night. Who is Anthony Barr?
Anthony Barr played linebacker for UCLA. It's kind of an interesting story. He went to the school as a running back. He wasn't playing and pretty much asked his coach, can I switch to defense? And he became a linebacker. He became an All-America who was really known for his pass rushing skills. And the Vikings really, obviously, they need help with their defense based on what happened last year. And they are very, very unsettled at the linebacker position. So he could make an impact sooner than Bridgewater. In fact, you would expect him to be on the field much more often and pretty quickly in his rookie year.
Of course, other rounds of the draft are coming up over the next couple of days. But I'm wondering, do you think that this draft, specifically the Bridgewater pick, will be kind of a pivotal point in Rick Spielman's career?
Oh, I think so. I think there's a lot of pressure on him. He's had some successes and some failures. Last year was a very, very interesting draft. He picked up three players, including he traded back into the first round last year to pick up Cordarrelle Patterson from Tennessee, and that really worked out well. But the quarterback position with the Vikings has been such anything from unsettled to kind of a running joke last year that he took a quarterback in the first round and that he chose Bridgewater rather than some of the other available options. Yes, this could very well be one of the defining moments in Rick Spielman's tenure as the Vikings general manager.
All right. Howard Sinker, always a pleasure. Have a good weekend.
And there's just two more days of draft to go. We're all very excited.
Howard and Kathy Werzer get the last words after a week of NPR News Update podcasting. I'll be back here on Monday with the news on your schedule. If you're a mom, happy Mother's Day.